Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
David Dreeman with us. He's the author of Contrarian Investment Strategies, The Psychological Edge. He's the chairman and managing director of Dreeman Value Management, a firm that pioneered contrarian strategies on the street and manages over $5 billion of individual and institutional funds. Regarded as the dean of contrarians, he's the author of the critically acclaimed Psychology and the Stock Market and Contrarian Investment Strategies. Dreeman is also the senior investment columnist at Forbes magazine. Articles about the success of his methods have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Barron's, and the list goes on. Let's say, David, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. David, when we take a look at investment and the stock market today and the economy, which we're really not too sure of, what is that something? What is that overarching theme that you've found that there can be at least a modicum of safety to keep people comfortable when they do invest?
Well, I think the in today's market, investors are very anxious, and I think they very justifiably should be. The one thing that gives me some comfort, and I think a lot of professional investors, is that we're through the worst of it. 2008 was it was like almost sailing off the edge of the world.
Sure.
And now we're coming back, and there's no question the economy is, particularly unemployment, is coming back much more slowly than we would have wanted. But
sure.
We're not turning down again. And we seem to be making, since of around April or May, we've been making some progress. And secondly, I think the stock market is really very cheap. It's probably, when you look at, say, the measures like price-earnings ratio or other valuations, it's as cheap as it's been in almost 20 years. On next year's earnings, the S&P is trading about 13 times, 14 times earnings, which is really very, very low. And finally, companies have major amounts of cash, which they didn't have in 2008. So they built up a tremendous cash reserve, and they're conservative. They're not expanding quickly. They want to make sure that the economy, they're not ahead of the economy, but they have enormous cash, and corporate America is in pretty good shape.
David, let me tell you what I'm looking at, which I think is phenomenally interesting with what you've done here. I've got your press material in front of me, the releases. And from what I'm saying is investment today in and of itself is almost a behavior. It's taking on its own form, its own culture. And every behavior has an attitude. It has an impetus behind it, and there's a reason why it does what it does. And if you talk about cognitive psychology, we're looking at the stock market as a behavior, almost as an entity unto itself with a behavior. And if we understand the behavior, we can work through all the challenges that we're faced with.
Yes, I think that's really what the book emphasizes. And there, this is fairly new work. I'd written a book roughly in 1997, and much of this work was had not even been done. So the psychological researchers have actually found is that we can be so excited by the prospects of a stock as we were back in the dot-com bubble that we can overvalue it by 100 or even sometimes several hundred or as much as 1,000 or more times its real worth. And likewise, if we don't like a company or we think there are very bad times ahead, we can undervalue really first-rate companies by almost 80-90%. And we're in one of those markets where we have a very high volatility for a number of reasons, particularly the high, what they call high-frequency trading. So we're seeing investors like stability when they buy stocks. They don't want stocks to be down 40-50% in a day, which happened in the flash crash in 2010. And so the higher high-frequency trading and the higher volatility has frightened a lot of people out of the market. And I guess one of the important parts of this is that the investor can ride through this. It's harder than it was because of this enormous volatility. But the high-frequency traders and others who are, I think, are disruptive to the market aren't really taking positions. They're taking positions for the moment. If a market's going down, they'll short it and really accentuate the drive down. And likewise, if a market moves up, they'll move up and carry it higher than it would normally go. But if we know that they're not there for long, we can take it. We can find opportunities when they drive markets down, and I really take advantage of this behavior. It's tough to do because psychologically, when companies drop 10, 15, 20% or more, and we've seen them drop as much as the flash crashes over 60%, it's terrifying. But there are ways to get around this kind of fear, and that is what the book attempts to explain.
But isn't it also understanding it? You know, the new work in neuropsychology that you discussed in Chapter 12, the surprises, et cetera. And then stop me if I'm wrong here. Let me give you what I'm hearing. And looking at neurosciences, if somebody approaches me with something just I think is phenomenal, I'm going to get a shot of dopamine. I'm going to feel some good something about it, and I'm going to invest. That doesn't mean that stock is good, bad, or indifferent. It means that if I don't understand my own psychology and tie it to the psychology and the behavior of the stock market, I'm going to be in major trouble. So are we looking to hook up the two and balance here?
Yeah, Michael, that's exactly right. There's some mention that when markets move up, the reaction on many investors is like a shot of dopamine or something, some pretty strong drug. They really tend to overreact. They get very, very excited and they take it much higher than they should. And likewise, if the results are negative, they'll take much lower than they should. And what we've seen is that when we look at earning surprises, it really seems to fit in very well with neuropsychology, because with favorite stocks, for example, if they get a positive surprise, they don't do all that well. There's too much expectation built into it. They'll go up a little bit, not a lot. However, if I like a stock that's a real favorite today, and it gets a negative surprise, not talking about any one stock, but just the average of all these surprises, if they get a negative surprise, they tend to go down very sharply as a group.
Yeah, no question. I want to touch on something which I think is, I want to step ahead just for a moment. One of your talking points I think is critically important to address, and especially how it's going to affect the stock market with what's going on politically right now. It doesn't matter, you know, left, right, indifferent. That's not where I'm at with it. But the problem of the chronic unemployment and what we've seen, the jobs, you know, go to different countries, go to China, wherever the case may be, the outsourcing and the rest of it. And based on who comes into office, if Obama gets out of office, you're going to have a completely new look at how things should be run in the country. I would venture to guess if I was in the stock market, I mean, on the other side of it, if I was heavily involved, I would be very concerned right now about where I wanted to put money, because I don't know what this outcome is going to be in the next 10, 11 months or so. Because if we take it back from China and we create our own manufacturing, if we do what we've always done to be who we are, Now, all of a sudden, we're going to have a lot of people employed that weren't employed. Unemployment right now is they're going for 90 weeks. I know people on unemployment that are getting $500 a week. That's $2,000 a month. Why would somebody want to work? So this entire psychology of being employed and how we run the country is going to drastically affect the stock market and how people put money into it and where they put money.
I think you're right on the mark on that. Basically, we have major balance of trade deficits, and that's why they've extended unemployment benefits, and this is only a temporary extension.
Sure.
But just to get the country back on its feet, because over the last decade, we've lost to China alone, directly and indirectly, almost 2 million jobs, and what they call the Asian Tigers, Taiwan and Malaysia and many of the others, have gained another 500,000. So we've really lost almost 2.5 million jobs, maybe more than that. And we are a free trader, but we Ricardo was the economist that was in favor, came out with the free trade theories back in the early 19th century, and Adam Smith. They said you could only be a free trader with free traders, and
sure.
So we have to have more pressure on the Chinese to trade fairly. What they, and not only the Chinese, but a lot of the developing countries, pretty much shut us out of their markets, and they take our proprietary rights. Like Microsoft, for example, only sells 20% of all the software for computers in China. The rest is made in China, and it is just duplicated from Microsoft without paying any royalties. And if we looked at this across, say, just China alone, and I don't mean to scapegoat China, but there's more information on it than any of the other countries. If we looked at what the Chinese take from us, or mainly borrow from us, our balance of trade with China is probably like a $250 billion a year deficit. If they pay for the things that other countries pay for, we would actually have a trade surplus with China.
No, absolutely. And for some reason, David, and I'm going to say I don't know why, but if we take a look at it, you know, strategically, we've seen what's happened politically over the last 3-4 years, that we're in a position now that we have backed off of everything. You know, we're frightened to death of getting the pipeline to, you know, from Canada, because it might be some kind of an environmental problem somewhere. We don't want to drill for oil, so we give somebody, you know, another country billions of dollars to do so. So what we've literally done is we've given it away, we've taken it away from ourselves, and we put ourselves in a situation where more and more people today are getting dependent upon government. And I really believe that in and of itself has a tremendous effect, an impact on the stock market.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And for example, I think a clear case of this is the idea that we've actually, as a nation, we're almost totally self-sufficient in natural resources, other than say oil. But we've more than doubled our natural gas resources in the last findings in the last 10 years. And if we started to convert, use natural gas, as Boone Pickens and others have suggested, we could save something if our 18-wheelers would use natural gas, and some of our other large trucks and so forth. We would actually, just in transportation alone, save 2 million barrels of oil a day. So we certainly have the means of doing it, but the politicians up to this point haven't done it.
No, or
really even pushed for it.
And I really believe if you go back to the old standard, if you want to know where the problems are, you follow the money wherever that's going to lead you. Because if you go back, administrations come and go, parties come and go that are running the country, etc. But the only thing that really stays constant is business, and business knows what its focus is. Its focus is on money. And I think that's where the problem is, because if you take a look at some of the problems we've had, Republican, Democrat, independent, really doesn't matter. If you look at some of the problems, especially in the investment portfolios, it's gone over not 3 years, it's gone over 10, 15, 20 years, and it's the different administrations, the different psychology, the different attitudes that they have, and yet some of the same problems exist. So I would say some of the problems are intrinsic, they're inherent within the culture and the society and the way we do things, no matter who's in charge. So some of that has got to change, but we need to take a look at it and just, you know, kind of quote-unquote suck it up and be responsible and move forward.
Yeah, I think that's also something I would agree with, because the subprime was not the caused by the Democrats alone nor the Republicans alone. Oh. Both parties contributed in a major way to lowering our standards and having that crisis. And I think the same problem is there with oil and gas. As you said, it didn't matter whether it was a Republican or a Democratic administration. Both really have not taken strong enough action in, say, developing natural gas, which is a major resource for the United States. And we could actually be a net exporter of energy if we did this. And it's not impossible to do. In fact, it's quite easy to do if the companies are given accelerated depreciation on converting trucks, for example. I think really very quickly lower our dependence on oil within 3-4 years. I think our dependence could drop pretty significantly.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. We're starting to run out of time, but there's a very important important thought here, is that this, with the electric cars, obviously they save a tremendous amount of gas and so on and so forth, but you're going to pay $80,000-$90,000 for the car. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't looked at. You've got proponents, activists that say do this and do that, but what's the cost of the savings? And I ask that rhetorically.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it happened to us during the, I think we had an oil embargo, was it back in 67, 68, another one back in the 70s, and people would pay up for cars that ran on diesel, and diesel was cheaper than gasoline at the time, but it didn't take very long, and so people would pay up in the, you know, thousands of dollars to get diesel-driven cars. But lo and behold, once they started doing this, the price of diesel oil, fuel oil, went up as high or higher than gasoline in some places. So that wasn't a real answer, whereas I think the answer of really using the natural resources we have is natural gas and encouraging their use is a much better one. Green is a very good idea in principle, but it's not cost effective at this point in time.
No, and absolutely. David, I could talk to you all night about this. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Yes, the book would probably be in the major bookstores like Barnes & Noble and Amazon and quite a number of others.
Wonderful. And again, the book is The Contrarian Investment and Contrarian Investment Strategies. We've got to get that word in.
Psychological edge, yes.
Yes. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when the
there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jennifer Grisham with us, Dr. Jennifer Grisham, PhD. She's a career change expert. Career change expert helps people escape an unfulfilling career and discover the work that makes them come alive. She is the founder of the online course No Regrets Career Academy and the author of the popular career blog, I can say that, Everyday Bright. Jennifer, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael Wade.
Oh, and thank you for being here. Listen, after that, everything is uphill from this point forward. You know, I think what you're doing is absolutely brilliant, Jennifer, because of this. There are so many people who they get into a career, not a job, they get into a career, and it's the be-all, end-all when they're beginning. And they don't know until they get in and they've had the practical application to realize that maybe this is not what they were looking for. And then they're stuck. They're alone. They don't know where to find answers. And I truly believe that we need people like you to hold our hands and say, this is how you do it. You take the step and you move here. And what that does, it creates a knowing from an unknown fear factor.
Absolutely. You know, Pope Bronson said, failure is hard, but success at the wrong thing can lock you in forever.
Oh, sure.
And that's really what happens because nobody is taught how to even choose a career from the outset. And so you're really just making decisions in the dark.
No, and now, by the way, we're talking about probably, I'll pick a number, but I don't think I'm wrong, about 80-85% of the population out there. They just don't know, and there are so many choices that you can have, but it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know, and the choices that you've never been exposed to, so you're not even aware that you can have this and make yourself happy.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, they say 3 out of 4 Americans would change careers if the right opportunity came along, but they don't have a framework for judging what that right opportunity is.
Now, by the way, with all of the time that you spent in the Air Force, did you see this? Did you see people who got in particular career paths in the Air Force and realized once they got in, it wasn't for them, yet they had made the commitment and they had to complete?
Absolutely. I mean, it was really sad in a sense because the government offers such security, right? I mean, at least they did up until very recently. But, you know, you had this feeling of, I just have to hang in there another year, another 5 years, another 10 years, and then you get this awesome good deal of a retirement system. And so it really encouraged people to just hang in there, and they would start their life at 42. That was sort of the plan, right?
Sure.
I just need to hang in there for now, and then I can start my life once I retire.
You know, it's interesting, too, because with your background, Assistant Chief Scientist of the Human Performance Wing of the Air Force Research Laboratory. And that's really what it's about. We perform in certain ways. And I imagine that if you went anywhere, any country, any place in the United States, any given particular occupation or job, we're going to find categories that we fall into.
Behaviors. Yeah, you know, that was really the job that opened my eyes to what the choices that I was making or not making, as the case may be. I had wonderful bosses who were super supportive, and I believed in the work that we were doing, so we had an important job to do. And yet every time I would take a day off, I would want another day off. And that's when I finally realized that I knew how to look successful, but I didn't feel successful. And I had to figure out for myself how to define success, because, right, the science will tell you nature abhors a vacuum. So if you don't supply your own definition of success, society will give you one.
By the way, I just we're hearing you from two. Ah, there we go. Quiet, computer. What happened to the manual typewriters? Now we have computers. I went to your website and your video started and I couldn't turn it off. We're doing fine. But when you really come down to it, that's what people need today are coach and their coaches in specific areas. And when you're not happy in your career, it's going to affect your family, your social life, and it's going to affect everything else that you come in contact with. And I think that's critically important to take a look at.
Yeah, I think that's something that people really don't take into account. I know for myself, you know, again, something that really came to me was I have this beautiful daughter. She was 2 years old at the time. I just loved her to pieces. And yet my job was stressing me out so much that I was finding myself very impatient with her. I was being short with her. And I thought, my goodness, you know, look at what this is doing to the most important relationship in my life. You know, she's worth it. As scared as I was to walk away from $1 million in pay and benefits, let me tell you, she's worth it.
Oh, absolutely. But that's your life. What you walked away from was the you that you really didn't want to be. And it's the difference between when you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and smile as opposed to, oh, another day.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It really does. It changes your entire life. It changes your outlook on life. And when you're stuck back in that career, right, and you use that word so well, you really feel stuck, you can't imagine how big a change it's going to be when you're actually excited to wake up in the morning to go to work, and then you have a hard time going to sleep at night because you're still so excited. You're energized the entire day.
Yeah, I wonder how many people actually go through, there's no way to get a number, that really enjoy what they're doing and wouldn't change it for the world. And the point of contention is I'm going to go back to what was said early on, is that if you don't know something else is out there, how are you going to go find it and how are you going to work your way towards it?
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think has made me successful as a coach is that I sort of bring my scientific background and my desire to have a clear framework so that you have a basis for making these kinds of decisions. You know, you're not just trying something and then trying something else. And, you know, over time, even though there's nothing wrong with that approach, over time it really wears on your self-confidence. So having a framework for making decisions, I think, is really critical.
Oh, absolutely. The step-by-step, 1, 2, 3, 4, this is how you do it. Now, let me ask you this. How does somebody, let's use this practical. Let's say that I'm on Wall Street and I have a career in investments, and I really don't like it. It's everything what you and I just talked about. Now, I want to find something else. First off, I go to your website, I connect with you. What are the steps you take me through? How do you get me to look at what it is that could really create some fulfillment in my life?
Yeah, so I tell people that I teach them two basic things, how to find the clarity and the courage to do what they really want to do. So that clarity piece is critical because it's what most people miss, right? They want to jump right to the solution, and this is especially true for those overachiever types who went into investment or law. You know, they think that they have all the answers. So really focusing in on, again, defining success for themselves. So breaking away from the traditional markers of success like money and prestige, you know, making somebody else proud of you. I teach people, figure out what makes you proud of yourself, right? And what are your core values? So many people, they don't even know their core values, so they certainly can't live in accordance with them. And that creates a real mismatch. and how you feel good about your life. And then get in touch with your intrinsic motivation. You know, find those things that are pleasurable regardless of the outcome and make sure that those are being incorporated into your work. So that's how you define success. And then I teach people how to understand themselves in a multifaceted way. So, you know, there's a strengths movement and there's people who focus on personality and they want to spit out your new career like it's some sort of horoscope. Or they tell you, go follow your passion and figure that's all you need to know. I find that you need to find the intersection between those three things, passion, personality, and strength. And when you do that, if you start off thinking broadly and then narrow down, you'll come out of that process with, you know, three or four careers that you're seriously interested in, and then you have a framework to start test driving them, which is part of the overcoming your fear step.
The other thing that I think is very important, and you said it early on, it's definition. It's how do you define something? How do you look at something? Take the word love. You know, what does that mean and to whom? And that's really where the key is. If I can't define what success is for me, what happiness is for me, emotional satisfaction, security, whatever the case may be, if I can't define it, Jennifer, how am I going to find it?
Exactly. You have to be really specific. And I tell people that, you know, it should be something that you know on a daily basis, whether or not you're living up to that definition of success or not. And I think the other key here is that when you do this, success is not the thing that you're chasing, right? It's not the thing that you get to someday if you work really hard. Success, when defined properly, is something that you're living up to day in and day out.
Absolutely. And to basically get that definition down so you know when you've got it. If I don't, I can't emphasize this enough. If I don't define what success is for me, I could pass it up and not even see it.
Right, exactly. Right. And that whole idea of waiting for the right opportunity to come along, if you don't have that definition of success, you'll have no way of knowing if something is the right opportunity or not. And again, most people let others decide for them. I have so many clients who come to me and say, you know, I just took each opportunity that landed in my lap when all my friends and family said, wow, that sounds great. You couldn't possibly, you know, miss that. And so they took it even though they knew it was the wrong thing.
No, absolutely, because they got accepted by somebody else, the family, whoever it was, and they got spurred onward. They got attention for it. And if they hadn't got that attention, they might have looked elsewhere, which breaks it down to this. We are driven by what somebody else thinks. And that's one of the things that we have to get away from, because you never truly get to be who you are and do what you really want to do if you have to do it the way someone else thinks it should be done.
And I would say that, you know, you never totally get away from it, but at the same time, I think we don't give our friends and family enough credit. You know, when I actually explained to people why I was making my big change, you know, there were certainly plenty of people who called me crazy, but there were also, you know, my core support group, some of them even said, what took you so long? We've been waiting for this announcement for years. And so, you know, I think we don't give people enough credit when we tell people what we really want. And of course, that depends on you knowing what you really want. They're happy to support you.
Okay. And by the way, yes. And there are many cases where we try to live up to somebody else's standard of who and what we should be like. And that has to be a problem also. So I think the awareness of both sides of it, yes, you do need a support group. There is no question about that. But when it comes right down to it, you better find out, you in the general sense of the word, you better find out what it is that you truly want. And once you get it, is it going to be enough to satisfy you for a lifetime or three?
Right, exactly.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get more information about coaching.
Yeah, I offer a ton of free training on my website, No Regrets Career Academy. That's N-O Regrets Career Academy.com. Three content-packed training videos where I go into a lot more detail on those three steps for finding clarity and courage. And as you go through that, if you decide that you actually want to join the online course and get coaching from me, you'll have the option to do that. And I really look forward to working with people.
Wonderful. Hey, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. And realistically, the subject matter tonight is, it should be something that most people address, because there's a lot of unhappy people out there and they don't know why. And the why of it is because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time and they could be somewhere else.
You know, I like to tell people, ask yourself, how much is your happiness worth? You know, if you could buy your happiness off the shelf, how much would you pay for it? And if you aren't investing that in yourself right now, then you're really missing out.
I got it. $8.12.
Thank you so much, Michael Ray.
Good night.
Good night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know you're gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Patricia O'Connor with us. She's the author of The Judas Circle. She was born, raised in Ireland, and has worked in as a management consultant in Britain, Ireland, and North America. She's well-known as a television presenter and has written, produced, and presented numerous motivational videos and training manuals for companies for network television. She's appeared many times on BBC Television and the RTE in Ireland. She studied media and journalism and business administration. She's a member of the Writers Guild of Great Britain and the Irish Writers Union, and has written business and training manuals. And for the past 15 years, O'Connor Smith and Associates have been involved in training management and employees with Fortune 500 companies. And let us say, Patricia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
I got through that. I really did.
You did very well. My gosh.
Thank you. And in your spare time, you do what? Okay.
Oh, my
okay.
Gosh.
Now,
probably
the Judas
walk my dog. No, I write books, as you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I got you loud and clear. By the way, the Judas Circle sounds like somebody stepped into something that they weren't aware of, and somebody got away with something but didn't know who they were dealing with.
That's exactly right. And it all started with a landslide in Sausalito. I had a home in Sausalito up in the hills.
Sure.
And I don't know if you remember, but in 1981, there was a huge amount of rain. It rained solid for about 10 days up in California.
Yeah, I was
and
there.
And what it did was it undermined the highway behind our house. And they were, you know, trying to sort it out. And what happened was, because of the banging, all of everything loosed up and came down on top of our house. and it pushed it off its foundation with us in it.
Oh, good.
So that was the beginning. And we ended up having to go into Chapter 11 in order to get, you know, be able to hold off, because we had to pay so much money to try and shore up the house. And after, the insurance company, of course, said, you know, it's act of God. You know the old act of God?
Yes, anything is insured except for the acts of God, yes.
That's right. So we had to sue them for it. And it took about a year before we actually got our money. And then we paid everybody off, including their interest, their complete interest, you know, anybody that we owed anything to, and went out of the Chapter 11. Now, when we checked our credit bureau, they had not removed any of that bad stuff from our name. And that was when we first met Mark Erickson, an attorney. He was a tax attorney that worked in the building where we worked in Walnut Creek. And we had him go with us to the TRW Credit Bureau to have him clear up our name, which he did. And after that, we worked with him. He was our tax attorney, did our taxes. And my husband and I, at the time, we were remodeling houses and, you know, making money. It was like a hobby for us, really, because our main job was stockbrokers. We used to sell AA-rated bonds to our clients. We just specialized in that.
Let me hold you up just for a minute, Patricia. Let me ask you this. Let's reverse the situation here for a moment.
Yes.
If you weren't you and you had your book, The Judas Circle, and you had the book,
mm-hmm.
and you lived in a place that was very much like the place that all of this happened to you, what would you do differently?
Oh,
if you could have been pre-warned.
I would never have hired this attorney. He absolutely destroyed our lives, you know, with his underhandedness, and it turned into an absolute disaster. I mean, you know, you think that you know somebody, and they become almost a friend to you, and then when they turn on you, it can be so detrimental.
Okay, but how did he turn on you? Where was that point?
What happened was, as I was saying before, the bond client investors that we had saw what we were doing with real estate and wanted to get involved in it. And so we decided to build out a small project in Blackhawk, which is a really lovely area in Northern California. And they went in on it with us as limited partners. Now, within about 8 months, the homes had been built and they'd been sold, because they were sold almost the minute they were built. One of them was sold before it was even finished. And the investors got their full amount of money back, and they also received a nice big profit, you know, on their investments. And if you could believe it, they started bitching because they had to pay tax on it. So then they said, well, what about us going into a bigger project, a larger project, so that it lasts for more than 1 year? And Mark Erickson, our attorney, wrote both of these partnership agreements. The first one he wrote just fine. The second one, he put a clause in there that any investor who had 51% of the investment could, without any reason at all, take over the project. And we were so stupid, we trusted this guy and never even thought that that was a dreadful thing. I mean, when I look back now, I feel like I was an idiot, you know?
Okay, well, but not necessarily, and the reason I say that, Patricia, it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that you don't know. And when you end up trusting somebody and they walk you into something like this, you know, 9 out of 10 times, obviously, just like what happened to you, it's too late. It doesn't necessarily mean that because somebody's a stockbroker or they're in a real estate business, they're adverse at all in contract law. And I learned years and years ago, you do something with somebody, you get two opinions of that project or whatever those papers are, and then you move forward. Because if I wanted to do that to you, and I've somehow moved my 51% ownership, you're mine. Everything I do, you have to do because I've got the final word. So obviously that was a problem. Now, if you could have seen it ahead of time, what would you have done?
Oh, I would definitely have gone to someone else and had them check out what he was doing. But, you know, I never even thought of that because I really trusted him. And
sure.
This man had been working with us for like 5 or 6 years. But, it was a very lucrative project. And when it was actually all built out, one of our main investors bought a number of the other people out to get his interest up to the 51%. And he went after the project. And he was helped by our attorney, which is absolutely amazing. You know?
That's something called collusion. Yeah.
Oh, of course it is. I know, and I don't know how
collusion,
they got away with
fraud.
It.
Fraud. Let's keep going here. Yeah.
Yeah, and then this was the next thing that happened. I was in my office one morning in Walnut Creek, and this horrible man came busting into my office. And his name was James Wickersham. He was a lawyer, and he was a lawyer for the investor who had tried to take over the project. And he leans over my desk, and he tells me that he and his client, Stadelhofer, planned to destroy me. He then said that he had told the FBI and the IRS about me. And when I asked him, why would you do that? I haven't done anything. He told me that that was the way that he did his business. On every case, he first turned it over to the FBI and the IRS to scare the pants off of people. And then he said it made his life real easy because people would settle out of court. You know, they were so afraid of the FBI and his contacts with them, and the IRS, that people would actually settle out of court. He said the IRS did his dirty work for him.
Did you ever get even with him? And when I say even, I don't mean anything
nasty.
Well,
you know, the only way I've gotten even with him is writing this book, because, you know, my feeling is I think other people will be protected by you know, reading it. You know, I get so angry when I think of it. I feel like such a fool all this happened. But, I mean, for some strange man to come busting into your office that you don't even know and say to you that he plans to destroy you, you know, it's hard to believe that that could happen in America.
Absolutely, no question. It's hard to believe that would almost happen anywhere, but we're dealing with, quote unquote, the fear factor. Somehow he felt that he could do that, scare you enough to back you off so you would be no resistance to him. I think the book is great, by the way.
I'm glad.
Yeah, because people need to know.
They do. And it's the only way to protect them. And at least I'm able to get some of the pain out of my heart over this, you know?
Sure.
To get rid of some of it by writing it.
Well, take it a step farther. It's not necessarily the money is important, of course. It's not just $10 or $100. There's a lot of money involved.
Yeah, no, it isn't. It was a $7 million project.
Sure. But more than that, if you did not have any kind of inner strength at all, you could have committed suicide.
Oh, I know. I was to the point, I mean, at the time when all this was going on, unfortunately, I had to go into hospital for major surgery. And the whole thing just was so destructive, you know, to me.
Oh, no question
then,
about it.
Well, then the next thing that happened was the FBI seemed to believe this guy. And they never went out to see the project. What they did was they went to the San Francisco Chronicle and told them that we had absconded with $1.6 million. Now, that was the amount of the original investment.
Yeah.
Now, when this man took over our project, there was $2,250,000 in the coffers. And the reporter never checked it out. The FBI agent who said that we had done all this never went to see the project. His comment was, it would have been a nice sight. He never bothered to go and see that 24 homes had been built and that 20 of them had already been sold and people were living in them, and they were beautiful homes.
You know, it's too bad that we don't have something called integrity when it comes to that level of money. And it seems as though I really don't like saying what I'm going to say. But when it gets to a point where the money hits a certain level, integrity seems to go out the window and people get taken over. It's almost like a drug. They're like, in, you know, they act different. They experience life different and they do things that will hurt people. And it's amazing what will happen to people who do this. Now, he hasn't got his comeuppance. You got the book out. Now, what about your attorney? When I say your attorney, I hope you're protected with this, because if there's an accusation and you can't prove it's, you know, it's so.
Well, I can prove all of them, all of it, because I have it all documented.
By the way, I'm on your side.
In the papers, you know? I mean, it's right in the court documents.
Yeah.
And interestingly, you know, this our attorney, Erickson, that I was talking about, well, one day I was on our building site. This is before they had taken it over and started to take it over. And one of our contractors, he was our grading contractor, he stopped doing his grading and asked to speak to me. And he said to me, are you still working with Mark Erickson? And I said, yes, he's written the partnership agreement for the project. And this gentleman said, oh, I feel sorry for you. He said, I've got to tell you what he did to me.
Mm.
And it turned out that this attorney of ours had told this gentleman, you've made a lot of money this year, and I know a way that I can save you taxes. Now, what I want you to do is put $300,000 of your money into your wife's name, and I will come on as an executor of the money in case she has an idea that she might run off with it. And Pat went along and did this, the contractor, and about as soon as the money had been put in his wife's name, his wife divorced, left him, said she wanted a divorce, and guess who moved in with the wife? The attorney. And he took over Pat's couple of million-dollar home in Piedmont.
Patricia, and we're
then
starting
he
to
put an order that Pat couldn't come within so many yards of him without being arrested.
Well, wait, but Patricia, we're starting to run out of time, but I'm thinking if we did any more of this, I'm going to need some Prozac.
I know. It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's like, you know, they get a law degree so they can destroy people and use it to hurt people instead of helping people.
No, and by the way, and I hear you loud and clear, we are out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, get the book,
yes,
and get more information?
Yes, we do. It's www.oconnorsmith, and that's SMITH.com.
Wonderful. By the way, Patricia, thank you so much for joining us.
And it's O'Connor without the apostrophe.
I've appreciated your time, and the message should get out there, and maybe you can save a few people. And as we said before, you might even save a life.
Exactly. And thank you for your good questions.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
and a hand to hold the leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Tommy Hawkins with us. He's the author of Life's Reflections, Poetry for the People, one of the nation's leading eclectic and former professional athletes. Tommy's enjoyed an incredible career as a two-year Notre Dame basketball All-American, 10-year veteran National Basketball Association player, and a player representative with the Los Angeles Lakers, a popular luncheon and dinner guest speaker and college lecturer, pioneering Golden Mike and Emmy Award nominated radio and television broadcaster, a public relations executive, and Los Angeles Dodgers vice president of communications. Tommy, I welcome to the show.
Michael, how are you? And thank you.
Oh, and thank you.
Love
so much.
That introduction.
By the way, I think the introduction is great. Now by the way, with a background like you have, the question that begs to be asked is this. Tommy, define poetry. What is poetry?
Well, poetry is expression in stanzas, or you can even say free verse, that expresses life situations in a way that is not, let's put it this way, it is not linear. It has rhythm. You use
yes.
metaphor. You use symbolism. You stimulate thought with these rhymes of reason and passion, dealing with any subject on the face of this earth.
And people resonate, and it's familiar, and they recognize themselves within the poem. And then the poem, Tommy, becomes about, yes, because it becomes about
go right ahead.
Yeah, that was it. And the poem becomes about them. The poem is not just
exactly.
Yes, absolutely. What stimulated you? Where was it, Tommy, that you sat back one day and you said, this is me. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this to pen and I'm going to create.
As a sophomore at the University of Notre Dame, a part of my sequence for my degree in arts and letters and in sociology was a year of English literature. This professor came in and he said, I'm going to teach you English literature this semester. My specialty is poetry. I will make it live in your souls. And I said, oh, God, we're going to start with Beowulf and the Canterbury Tales, and this man is going to bore me to death. Quite the contrary. Father Soletta, when he got to the poetry section, read T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And he read it so eloquently and with such passion and feeling that he engendered a love of poetic expression in me that has stayed with me all of my life. No, and that's how I got started.
And by the way, it stays forever. A poem in and of itself, there's a legacy within the poem. And each one of the poems that you've done, I'm, by the way, the book is great. I've got it in front of me. This is a keeper. This is going on the coffee table.
Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. But the point is it's saying, as a matter of fact, with Sugar Ray, from Ring Ovation to Youth Foundation, he lived to please the crowd. The legendary warrior did his best to make them proud. He's a fighter for the ages, a darling of the fan. Pound for pound, the greatest, he was the Sugar Man. What more could you say about him? You hear it?
Well, the thing is, and that's the value. You know, sometimes when you say poetry, I'm going to get to what you just said. But sometimes when you say poetry, people freak out. Oh my God, I couldn't stand that when I was in school. It's too esoteric. It died in some Greenwich Village coffee shop in the 1960s. It's nothing but mental masturbation. They go on and on with why they don't like poetry. And if poetry is too esoteric, yes, it can put all of us to sleep. But when the message is there with rhyme and reason and it's meat and it has some beef jerky that you can chew on, there is nothing like it. Nothing at all.
Let me tell you what I heard out of what you just said. The people who say that are people frightened to death to take a look at themselves. Because the poem will not just, you don't just hear it. When you experience it, it touches you to the heart. And there's too many people out there today, Tommy, that are afraid, frightened to death of themselves, frightened to death to feel emotions, to experience life because of either what somebody's going to say or they're just going to hide for the rest of their life. And I would believe that when somebody does that, A, they don't know. I take that back. They do know what they're talking about because they're frightened to death. And if you really hear their message, you can see why they won't read the poetry.
Well, that's very true. That's very true. And they miss out. I tell you,
Absolutely.
There are 45 narratives in this book, each one of them different, no redundancy, and each one of them, you will find yourself, you will find me, you will find members of your family, and you will find your friends.
Now, by the way, do you have your book in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go to ground zero, towards the back of the book.
Okay, I will go to ground zero. That's a hard-hitting one, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Would you please do that one?
Okay, let me get to it. I got everything on my lap here, and I'm glad you chose that one because most people shy away from it. And by the way, each narrative in this book is visualized by a photograph or painting by a major artist. And here we go. Shall I read it?
Sure, please.
Ground Zero. Screaming terror in full flight, hell-bent on annihilation, unmitigated hatred, thinking instant ruination. Horrific death of thousands, stench of evil everywhere. Headlines blast, grave new world. We watch with frozen stare. Heinous inhumanity, measured to the very minute. Insidious mass murder. Heed the message and find who sent it. Barbaric act of treachery, diabolically surreal. Fanatic death of fire, fanned by phony religious zeal. Echoes of Adolf Hitler reverberate ground zero as they dig for those who perished, hero after hero. The world shakes its troubled head in total disbelief, while New York mourns lost loved ones gripped with agony and grief. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, states the Bible as I read. With every justification, please exercise God's speed.
Tommy, you can't say it any better than that. People can give us information and they can talk about things. But some, I guess I can feel a tear coming up with this. And, but when you're dealing with something like this, poetry, if you want to call it anything you want to call it, but whatever it is that you're doing, hits the heart, the familiarity. You cause the person who's reading it to live within the words. And when you can do that, then you've accomplished the goal.
Well, the goal, you know, it's difficult because, you know, you say, okay, you read that and you did that in 45 seconds or a minute. How long did it take you to write that? Ground Zero took me 7 weeks to get everything that I wanted to say in the order that I wanted to say it with the rhythm that I wanted it to be expressed. And it's right there and accompanying the poem or the narrative. Ground Zero are these two massive buildings on fire with smoke and soot and grit and horror reeking from the pages.
Now, by the way, with your permission, we're going to take it a step farther, because in the right time and the right place, that poem will get read over the air time and time again. See, that's the key. That somebody else here.
Please do it. Just give me the credit.
Oh, no, absolutely.
because I think it's important. If you were saying to a young school kid, well, what's Ground Zero and what happened? And how can you size this up for me? These narratives are well worth taking to the schools and letting schools get into different phases of life. You know, I go from Ground Zero to psychoanalysis, to gambling and our propensity to expect to win that lotto sooner or later. Just a whole host of things.
Let me tell you what I think that why this thing is so gutsy, all right? There's this thing called vulnerability, Tommy. Most people are frightened to death to open up and let people see inside them. If you read this, especially the person in the mirror, if you go through the book and you capture it, you know, Tommy Hawkins is right out there. And if somebody doesn't know you through this, Tommy, they're never going to know you.
I thank you for that. And that's true. It's okay to be vulnerable, but I think that, Michael, you hit the nail right on the head when you say that people are afraid of being vulnerable because they are afraid of being taken advantage of. Well,
sure.
You know, what you see here in me is what you get. I'm not hiding. I'm expressing life's reflections as I've lived them, as I have seen them, and they're very important. Michael, may I do a very short one for you?
Please.
And I don't know how old you are, but you get to a point in your life where you like to recap what you've done. You know, you relive life situations. So I wrote a short poem called Recapitulation, and it reads, "Memories can often haunt me and refuse to go away. In this world of recollection, I find myself today, gazing at old photos, reliving days and nights, probing magic moments, tugging at fallen kites. I do my best to reconcile the eclectic life I've led, reaching for puzzle pieces that are dancing in my head. I know I can't go home again or keep the music playing, yet recapitulation sometimes sends this hound a baying. Foolishly, yeah. I revisit episodic interludes, then deal with life's realities that so factually intrude. What would have happened if, my God, what a senseless game, but I still insist on petting this beast I will never tame."
Let me give you this about age. You know, the one you've got in here, 60s Revisited. In the 60s, I was already out of high school.
Okay.
Yeah, I was out there and I was living the world. So that was, it was a good time. Now, if you'd have said the 40s and 50s Revisited, then you'd have had me.
Okay, right, right.
But I got it. When you really come down to it, that's what it is, and it's the truth, and it's everybody's truth. What you captured is the essence of truth, and that's why the book will be the book, and they'll put it up on their, they'll put it out on the coffee tables, and they'll keep the book, and they'll go back and look at it, and then they're going to find a favorite poem, and they're going to call people, or in the right time and the right place, they'll point to this and say, listen, listen to this, and they'll hear. So I'm so happy you did this, because I think, as far as I'm concerned, Tommy, this is a gift.
Well, thank you so much. Professional athletes aren't supposed to write poetry. This is the first book of its kind ever done by a professional athlete. And no, I'm very proud of that. And the visualization, the writing, it took years in the making. And I used to have to hide the fact that I wrote poetry from my teammates when I was playing professional basketball, because they would say, "You're doing what? You're writing poetry? I'm going to tell the guys." And I'd say, "Oh, no, don't tell the guys, because, you know, they rag on you for a week, you know." Jerry West once said to me, "You're doing what?" I said, "I'm writing poetry." So he says, "Roses are red, violets are blue. Little Tommy is writing his poetry too." You know, and he'd go away and he would laugh, and that's what it was all about. But I was dead set on being able to express all of these things. What life is all about, what introspection is all about, what feelings of love are all about, and all of that. And I feel free to do it. And at my age, I say, hey, if someone doesn't like what I do, fine. This is my offering to the world, and I hope that the world receives it.
Now, by the way, how old are you?
I'm 74.
Okay, see, I wouldn't tell anybody, so it's our secret. I'm not that far behind you. I'm 69, okay? So you and I came from a world, where you didn't write, you know, tough guys don't write poetry. What are you talking about? And it came from a world that a lot of the kids today will never understand. It was different. And there's the key. You're right. But it came out, and it was there. You're a professional athlete. Obviously, you're not a pushover, no question about it. But the point is if you move below that strength, the real strength comes from what's inside. You know, we can be tough guys and go out and prove the world, you know, how bad we are. But the real power is what you hold inside. And that keeps you constant. That keeps you moving through relationships. And that keeps you moving through life.
Exactly. And as you move through this book, you will see all kinds of life situations. Example, yesterday's Gardenias deals with how at certain times in our lives we love flowers and everything, but all of a sudden we get so busy and we're under such strife we forget about them. And like the petals on a rose, you know, things start to fall apart and everything, and we don't re-nourish them. We don't get more, you know, we don't finish those things. And people are afraid to look at themselves. There's some personalities in here. I did a thing on a very close friend of mine whose images, or several of his images, are in the book, Leroy Neiman, and what he is all about and his type of artistic expression and everything. I really went out on a limb to do my reflections of my father, who wasn't there as I was growing up, and my reflections on my mom, who was there and was everything. And I wasn't afraid to do it. Fine, this is it. What you see is what you get. except when you look in the mirror.
No, but see, that's the thought. That's the mindset. We're starting to run out of time, Tommy. But that's the mindset of somebody as old as we are, quote unquote. And some of the kids today, I wish they could go back and just get retrained in a certain way and then take the world on. But we have what we have, and what you've done here, it's a legacy. 100 years from now, somebody's going to sit down and say, did you see the poem on this page? And that's where the key is. Now, would you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, and find out more?
Yeah, you can go to TommyHawkins.net, TommyHawkins.net, and you can get my website, and you can find out more about the book, and you can also purchase the book through the website. PayPal is involved there, and just put your credit card there, and I'll send you the book right away.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it, and don't let anybody.
Michael, thank you very much.
Okay, Tommy, my pleasure. Take care. Good night.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah. Some of these days you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long. For you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dressing After Dark. Veronica Gray with us. She is the author of Newly Discovered and Never Before Published Secrets to, listen to the words, Eternal Youth, She researched it. She's a surfer, a holistic health practitioner, an award-winning author, and she is known as the Surf Lady. She's a UCLA graduate and a USUI certified Reiki practitioner. Helms the charity Eternal Youth Empire, which has published 12 books. Now, when she was a child, she was kidnapped by her father from her mother for 9 years of missing childhood, which may be why she's now obsessed with capturing youth. And let's say, Veronica, hi, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, and thank you. I'm throwing all my pillows away.
Well, you should.
That's realistic. No, I saw this. One of the secrets we don't talk about, it's never sleep with a pillow.
Well, yes, that's the beauty of our secrets. They are 100% free to test for yourself to see that they do work. So in our book, we go into real scientific detail why simply sleeping without a pillow will make you age 1/3 less than the rest of the population. So if you're 60 years old, you'll look like you're 40.
Well, now we're talking. The pillows are going tonight. Okay. And Radio Susie, Susan Greenman, sitting across the desk from me with all the computers sitting in front of her. I just saw her make a note, throw pillows away.
Yes, and it doesn't matter if you sleep on your back or your side. That's not the point. The point is just simply having your head aligned with your heart. That's all. And we go into great detail in the book on our website, eternalyouthandimmortality.com. So depending on how much detail you'd like me to go into, I can go into it. But if you just lose the pillow, you will gain 1/3 of your youth back.
I'm there. By the way, where are you?
I'm in Venice. Are you able to hear that plane?
I know. That's what it was. It was a plane coming. I thought they were coming to capture us. I was going to wear the tinfoil so the rays couldn't get me from outer space. Okay. No, that's good. You're fine, Veronica. That's fine. No problem. I wasn't quite sure what that was. All right. But not so much of the total why, but just one key idea of letting go of the pillow. How does that cause you to look and feel younger?
Okay, so the pineal gland is what regulates how we age. It's in the back of your brain. It works like an hourglass. So anytime we are upright, it's like sand dripping down the hourglass. That's time passing. So if you are ever laying completely horizontal because of the way the pineal gland is situated, time can't pass. If you lay an hourglass on its side, sand can't slip through the hourglass. Are you following that visual?
Absolutely.
Okay, so imagine if you have an hourglass completely flat on its side. Sand can't pass through. That means time can't pass. So if you propped up the hourglass on a pillow, you're actually still having sand pass through or time pass or aging. So obviously, as we go through the day, we can't all be going through the day horizontal. Every time we are upright or erect, that's time passing. That's how the pineal gland senses us. That's how we age. So the only way we can really help ourselves is that those 6 or 8 hours we're in bed, if you remove the pillow, time can no longer pass. And so we do go into greater scientific detail about that, but that is the real simple layman's terms. If you just remove the pillow, if you're spending 6 to 8 hours a night in bed, time doesn't pass those 6 to 8 hours.
Now, by the way,
that's up to 1/3 of your life.
Now, by the way, I don't want to give all the secrets away because if they want them, they have to go get the book. But just one or two, watching TV commercials sitting a certain way, what does that do?
Okay, so it's the same thing. If you can spend 6 to 8 hours a day where you're laying completely flat, why not in between watching TV commercials lay completely flat too? Because we have found that if you can lay completely flat 30 minutes a day, you're doing a great service to yourself as far as age reversal goes. And this is proven to be more effective than Botox, more effective than plastic surgery. Why do you think yogis are always encouraged to do headstands? Because they're reversing their age. They're putting sand back into the hourglass. So while you're sitting in TV during commercials, just lay completely flat. And if you can do that, you know, TV commercials are usually 4 to 5 minutes. If you do that even 6 times in one day during, you know, in between your TV shows, you've done your age reversal for the day.
Now, question, where was it that you found this? Not so much the place you found it. Where was it when you sat back and you said, I'm going to do this research. I'm going to find something. I'll find things that nobody's ever thought of before. What stimulated you and how did you find these things?
Okay, well, I was traveling in the late 90s through Europe, and I came across books in Amsterdam that told us about the pineal gland and how it senses time. And so I just connected the dots. I like to research, and that was sort of what I did at UCLA. And I connected the dots. I was like, well, that's how the pineal gland senses time. So if we aren't going to be elevated in a certain way, then time wouldn't be passing according to our bodies. And then I talked to many yogis and they said, yeah, that's why they're always doing inversions. And that's kind of why that vampire bats that are associated with immortal vampires, they hang upside down. There's a reason, you know, a lot of myths, fables, and legends are somewhat based in truth and reality. So when I discovered this and I put it together, I presented it to the only serious institute for anti-aging in America, the Buck Institute. There's only 3 institutes for anti-aging in the entire world, and there's only one in America, the Buck Institute in Marin County. And so I physically went there myself. I met with scientists myself, and I said, this seems really simple. It's almost like too good to be true. But I wanted to present it to them because I didn't want to start going out to the masses and spreading something that might be wrong. And so they couldn't find anything wrong with our theories. So I'm really happy to be able to share them with everybody because they are simple. They're free to try in the comfort of your own home. And we do give that particular secret away on our website for free in great detail. Sorry about the planes.
That's okay. Wait, that one's coming. Where are you, at the airport? There you are. Okay.
I'm actually, yes, headed for the Sundance Film Festival.
Ah.
So sorry about that.
No, that's
I'm very
okay.
Near the airport, yeah.
Yeah, no, but no, that's fun. It adds something to the show. Okay, so basically this has to do with the pineal gland. And if you learn to work with it, it's almost like it neutralizes the clock for a while, and it doesn't reverse your aging. It just stops the forward movement of the aging. Do I have this right?
You do have it right, Michael, but it does reverse the aging anytime that you can be inverted.
Oh, okay.
Have you ever seen pictures of inversion tables where people do inversion table therapy?
Sure.
It helps their back. So anytime you are inverted, you are literally reversing your age, and that is a fact. There's a book by somebody named Dr. Daniel Amen. He has researched over 45,000 people who did inversions, and it showed how he did brain scans, and their brains are younger after they did inversions. And we do, like I was saying before that last plane came by, we do go into this in great detail for free on our website on eternalyouthandimmortality.com, so you can see that it does work.
Okay, so now let me ask you this. How long, now I've seen a picture of you on your website. Now, I'm not going to ask you how old, but
I don't mind saying, because I like to say I'm a walking billboard, and all those pictures are recent. They're all within the last 2 months. And I've been on this planet 37 years.
Okay.
All right. I've never had any work done. I don't do Botox, nothing. That's just me. And I'm always, you know, getting mistaken for at least in my 20s.
No, that's great. I see it right now. That's gorgeous. I think that's absolutely wonderful. Now, more and more people starting to use the process?
I hope so. More and more people are coming forward and asking me to do interviews. And so I feel like people sort of know when something seems to sound truthful to them or something resonates with them. And why would I be out there trying to, I'm not selling any product associated with this, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but by the way, we're starting to...
Saying, I'll buy my special bed. Hello?
I know we're cutting on and off, but we're starting to run out of time. But I want to give you my great experience, Huntington Beach, Southern California, the first time I ever surfed. I went out there and everybody was roaring with laughter because I had the skag facing upward. No good. Okay.
Well, do you still surf? Where are you?
Oh no, I'm in the Midwest. I'm in the Milwaukee area now. But that was 100 years ago, and that was, boy, I hate to say that. I was probably in my 20s, and that was more years than I want to talk about. I'm going to throw my pillows away and get upside down. It's about time. I'm not kidding about that. All right, Veronica, one more time, please, with your website.
EternalYouthAndImmortality.com.
Wonderful.
Or they can also go to the SurfLady.com.
I got it. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think it's great. When you really come down to it, it's all centered in and around the pineal gland. And if you understand it, then you can work with yourself. Good work. That's great.
Thanks, Michael. I hope you can catch a wave one of these days.
hey, thanks. Okay, good night.
Off comes. Good night. Have a good evening. Thank you.
Good night.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out.